Lectionary Lab Live is recorded by Two Bubbas and a Bible live from Gainesville, Florida and Brasstown, North Carolina. Welcome, everybody, to the Lectionary Lab Live. I'm John Fairless. I'm here with my bubba, Delmer Chilton. Say hey, bubba.
Hey, bubba.
Man, good to hear you today. We're going to get going on a few texts. We're going to talk about preaching this week. These are the texts for the 17th Sunday after Pentecost, September the 16th, 2018. You and I have both been traveling this week. As we sit here recording the show today, we are waiting the impending arrival of Hurricane Florence a little bit later on in the week. So there's just all kind of excitement in the air. Who knows what's going to happen by the time we get this show out. Maybe that's a way of me saying, if y'all think after hearing us today, them boys weren't particularly focused. I don't know that we're offering any excuses, but we wanted to get out and we wanted to talk about these texts. And Bubba, I believe we're just going to take off with the gospel today. Think about how the other texts support it. Tell us what you got on your mind.
Mark's gospel has one of those stories that everybody knows embedded in it. And you can get focused on that. Get behind me, Satan. It's even so popular that old Flip Wilson used to have made a joke about it, you know, on his show. I remember that from the 60s. It's kind of one of those things. And you can get fixated, if you will, about that part of the text and miss a lot of really important stuff. Yeah. And so that's an important piece in here. But you need to look at what happens before and after to get the full flavor of what Mark's getting at with this story about Jesus. So I just want to walk my way through the text, if that's all right. Mm-hmm. And on the very first verse 27, there are the words on the way that just percolate for me. One of the things to understand is that where we are in the Mark's gospel, we're in chapter 8, we're in the middle section. And I think this use of on the way is not by accident.
Correct. I'm with you there.
You know, because early Christianity was referred to as the way and very frequently was called the way. And so Mark is saying, setting this up, this is a real turning point in terms of what Jesus is asking of his disciples and where the disciples are and what's going to be happening with on the way. He asked his disciples. I think one of the preaching points here is to say, you might launch into a sermon on this of talking about, you know, we are constantly on the way and we always need to be asking ourselves the question, who is Jesus to us? Absolutely. So this is a launch into a sermon here to talk about being on the way, and we're always on the way. Not ever arriving, but always on the way and always every day asking ourselves the question. One of the great lines Lutherans love is somebody about Luther talking about being born again every morning. And he referenced, you know, we get up every day and we ask ourselves, what am I doing today for the Lord? Who is Jesus and who am I?
Right.
We're on the way all the
time.
On the
way. Yeah, very. I just want to jump in quickly to say I really love that interpretation. And again, from my tradition, there can be an emphasis on, hey, have you been saved? Talk about the day you were saved, the day you became a Christian, as if it's a fixed point in time, when really the language is much more consonant with it's a process, it's always ongoing, we are always being saved, and I like this, we are always on the way. And so on the way with Jesus makes a great way to look at it today.
Yeah. And then, so it's interesting the way Mark sets up the two questions. One is, who do people say that I am? And then it gets followed up with, who do you say that I am? And how frequently this just shows, let me reframe it. This just shows what a deep understanding of people the writer of Mark had. Mm-hmm. How much throughout life are we so much worried about what other people think?
Yeah.
Who do people say that I am? And he's testing with, Jesus is working with the disciples about how is he being interpreted and what are you hearing and how are you responding to that? I walked out of a grocery store Sunday, and a woman came across there, and she, I hadn't seen this in years. She had this blouse on and it had Calvin across her chest, you know, Calvin Klein, I guess, obviously. And Calvin.
Well, you never know.
But I mean, it was gold and shiny and all.
Oh, okay.
And I was just like, I wonder what John Calvin would think about that. You know, that came to my mind. But then what would John Calvin think of this was one thing. But the other one was, by what motivation do we buy clothes with the designer's name on the front or on your pocket or wherever? And then you begin to think about how many things we do because of what other people say mm-hmm. about that. And you mm-hmm. bring that down to, who do people say that Jesus is? Who do people say that I am? Wow. Now there's an interesting question, you know,
Who do we say? Well, I, you know, we're always thinking about connections to, we talk about connections to real life, connections to our context,
yeah.
and helping the folks that are going to be sitting in our pews, somewhat listening to us, make a connection. So I almost get this image of Jesus. The first question is kind of like a Gallup poll or, you know, ABC News poll. You know, what are the people saying? Well, 34% think you're a lot like Elijah, and another 28% are calling for John the Baptist. You're sort of going, but the real important question is not what everybody else thinks. The real important question is, but who do you say that
right.
I am?
Right.
And yeah, brings it down.
We can get really influenced positively and negatively by who other people say Jesus is.
True.
You know, and, you know, we need to really then deeply examine. What's interesting about the answers in the text, John the Baptist, he was dead. So there's evidence of some kind of belief in reincarnation. There is a sense. But there is building toward a sense that Jesus is someone in whom God is doing something extraordinary.
Right.
And God has had to do a mighty act to make Jesus be who he is, but there's still, none of these answers are quite the Messiah. This is the point, you know, it's a very clever build-up to the Messiah. Elijah, who went off into heaven and never died, and everybody's waiting for. You know, that's close to messianic, you know.
Yeah.
Elijah will return, or one of the other prophets, you know, sort of you know, everybody's got their favorite, you know, maybe it's this. it reminds me of the anonymous letter in the New York Times, you know. There was this letter.
Who is it? Yeah.
But the next day, everybody's like, who wrote that? And then people are doing lists. It's kind of like, okay, Jesus has got to be one of the prophets. Which one is it? And they're arguing back and forth about what he chose. But all of it says he is an agent of God.
Right.
Somehow he's an agent of God. And then, so we look at Jesus and we keep saying, well, who's everybody else say he is? We keep reading books about who Jesus is and who Jesus isn't. Ultimately, you got to push all that aside and you got to say, who do you say that he is? Mm-hmm. Who do you say that I am?
Yeah.
Well, Peter jumps up, the Messiah. As usual, Peter had no idea what he was talking about. At what level? I mean, he had identified that Jesus was the Messiah. He got that. You are the Messiah. But he didn't understand what it meant.
Right.
And there's where the key issue is. He knew he was the Messiah. He said, I'm going to take a leap. This is the Messiah. This is what we've been waiting for. And he's, all right, don't tell anybody, which is that whole messianic secret thing that you can, I'm not going to deal with much today. You can play with it because, but.
Well, we've seen it a couple of times coming up before. And point being, yes, this is the quote messianic secret, but it's a secret that can't be kept. It can't be hidden. It's coming out everywhere. Just like we saw with the healings. Hey, don't tell anybody. Well, here they come. So yeah, that's an interesting thing too. And so, yeah, go ahead. I got another idea, but I want you to finish.
No.
I want you to finish your train of thought.
So, train me already.
More like one of those pumper cars you see on the railroad tracks. You know,
I got it.
Train.
I got it back. So, when you say that, he says he's a Messiah, but he's not really clear about who that might be.
Yeah.
So Jesus lays it out.
Right.
You know, he began to teach them that the Son of Man undergo great suffering, be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed in 3 days, and in 3 days rise again. A couple of points here. First of all, this is a core of the early kerygma. It's pretty much the second article of the Apostles' Creed from the point of...
That's it.
You know, and it's there early on. This, you know, this is sort of the history of the development of doctrine, if you will. So this is laying this out there. And every Sunday, this is what we talk about when we get to the creed about Jesus at that point. From suffered under Pontius Pilate, crucified, dead, and buried. There you are. And third day
rose again.
Well, you know, obviously Peter quit listening at be killed.
Yeah.
The whole 3 days rise again, the whole positive ending, whatever. He never got there. He's like, what? Wait a minute. Now, this word rebuke means to prevent someone from doing wrong. It's very strong. Mm-hmm. It's not just, oh, wait a minute, I'm not sure we're on the same page here. Could I take a minute to disagree with you on that? This is stop! You can't, to prevent someone from doing wrong.
This is me running up to you when I see you about to really screw up and grabbing a hold of you and say, Delmer,
No.
Don't do that. Yeah, exactly. Don't do that. Yeah.
It is setting Jesus straight. You know, we would say, I had to get him aside and set him straight. That's what he's trying to do. Mm-hmm. He rebukes it. And then Jesus in turn, and notice this, but turning not at Peter and looking at the disciples.
Have I got everybody's attention?
He rebukes Peter in turn. He keeps him from doing wrong and sets him straight. And then we get the great line, get behind me, Satan. I want to finish that sentence in a minute. I want two things. The temptations in the wilderness, in which it said, and he departed to return to him at a more opportune time. This is a profoundly opportune time.
Right.
Here is the human side of Jesus. He's been teaching, preaching, adored. All these things are happening. And he's just been, he said, who do people say that I am? He's not a needy kind of like, what are people saying about me? Mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest prophet of them all? It's not that, but he's working with this thing. But they have just said, you're the Messiah. This is an opportunity one more time to turn in a wrong direction. And Peter invites him to turn away from what he knows is his role as the Messiah, suffering, death, rejection.
Mm-hmm. Jesus, why would you want to go down that road when your poll numbers are through the roof?
Exactly.
Everybody's looking for a Messiah. Everybody's looking for the victor, the victor. You know, you got it going on here. Why? Let's cut it with all that negative stuff. Nobody wants to sign up for suffering. Nobody wants to sign up for crosses. You know, nobody wants to sign up for that stuff.
So, there's the rebuke. Get behind me. There's that connection. And he's addressing the the Satan as the tempter, the one leading him aside. And he's not really talking to Peter. He's talking to Satan.
Now, this is the opposing force that has been there this whole time. Satan, you know, accuser, tempter, sidetracker, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
There are, and the rest of that sentence, and I'm going to come back to the second thing that get behind me Satan means, but the rest of that sentence is Jesus has said this in a variety of ways about setting one's mind on the what's below and not what's divine. Now, we can make that pie in the sky kind of thing, but what he's really saying is, yeah, if you look at this from a fully human point of view, it's easy to decide what we're supposed to do, right. and getting killed is not moving our movement forward. But from the divine plan of things, there is that the theology of the cross, Lutherans would call it, the giving of oneself. And then he unpacks that through the rest of this about lose one's life, will gain it, etc., is the divine mathematics, the paradox that goes with all of this. The second thing that get behind me, Satan, we've often seen that he's addressing Satan. He said, get behind me, let me get past this temptation moment. But I want to tie it a little bit to the language about follow. And he's looking at Peter. This is the language to Peter. It says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself. Wants to follow me, deny himself, take up a cross and follow me. Get behind me, follow me. Don't get in my way. Don't stand in front of me, blocking me. Get behind me, follow me. We can all be, with a little S, a Satan in terms of getting in Jesus' way.
Absolutely.
Blocking the path. We don't want it to go that direction, and we're stopping the divine things God is doing. And Jesus says to us, follow me, get behind me, come with me. Mm-hmm. So that's a powerful section in the middle there of what does it mean to confront the reality of who Jesus is. Are we going to get in the way? Or are we going to get behind and follow and take up our own cross and come with him? The piece that he moves into, then he looks at Peter and at us. Look at them. He looks at the disciples. We're in the disciples.
We're in the crowd. Group. There you go.
And he's saying, listen, let me explain what it means for me to be the Messiah and what it means for you to be my followers. It means taking up your own cross. And taking up a cross doesn't mean, well, I've got this arthritis, but that's just my cross to bear. Or my son married a girl I don't like. That's just my cross to bear. Or, you know, the boss at work is just so mean, but I guess that's just my cross. Anything that goes on in your life that's difficult that you don't want and you'd rather not have to, but you decide to put up with, is not your cross to bear. The cross to bear is taking up, moving beyond yourself and denying yourself and enhancing the life of someone else.
Yeah.
Dying a little bit to self so that others may live. That's taking up a cross. That's denying oneself.
Well,
and that's what we're invited to do.
I think you've hit on it here with that core tension in the text and the resolution. Get behind me and follow. Come on, this is it. Bearing my cross is following the way of Christ in the world. And that may lead to uncomfortable encounters and difficult situations, and it may cost, it certainly cost these early disciples probably a lot more in physical terms than it will cost any of us. But it is giving up yourself. If you're going to get in line, if you're going to follow Jesus, it is a denial of self, and it still is to this day. I'm going to jump in here with my idea from earlier, because this text is all together. It is of a cloth, so to speak. Go back to the two questions at the beginning. These are not just interesting questions in the historical context of what was happening with Jesus and the disciples. These are questions that are very much still being asked today. still bestsellers are written on who was Jesus. And as you say, there's all kind of opinions out there. And to my knowledge, our current president notwithstanding, Jesus has been on the cover of Time magazine more than any other character, for example, you know. So
Jesus didn't have to pay to get there.
Well, there you go. And I don't want to get off too much on that. The point being, the world is still fascinated. Who is Jesus? And there's all kinds of opinions. But for those of us of faith, those of us seeking to follow, the second question is still very much being asked and in need of being asked. It's a relevant question for us to come back to again and again. Who is Jesus to me? Who is Jesus to us, church?
Yep.
Okay, a community, family, who is Jesus to us? And then it leads to all sorts of other questions. Well, where is Jesus leading? Where is Jesus going? I believe the theology of the cross here is we got to get behind him. We've got to get with him, and we've got to follow him on his way. That determines the direction of our lives, not our will. Okay? As the garden prayer is going to come up later, not my will, but thine be done. And here it's just like Peter facing this point. And Jesus says, don't try to get out in front of me, man. Get behind me and follow me. So it's, powerful stuff here.
Well, and walking through some of the other texts today, and we're really doing a very lectionary-based kind of approach of the gospel driving the train and everything else being tied to it. So back in Isaiah, besides the fact that it talks about Jesus teaching a couple of times in here, and this is about if you teach, it's really tied to Isaiah 56, 50 verse 6, the turn my back to those who struck me, my cheeks to those who pulled out the beard. I did not hide my face from insult and spitting. So that's one type. I mean, that whole suffering, that's where it ties in. But I think a second one is in verse 7, where he says, I have set my face like flint. That's a beautiful image. And it may come in as you're preaching at the end of the sermon about what does it mean to get behind Jesus. And it's about Jesus has set his face like flint toward Jerusalem and the cross. He says to Satan, you're not going to divert me. You're not going to get me off that path. And we too are invited to set our faces like flint and stay behind Jesus.
Absolutely. Well, excellent points, I believe. And we've got a couple other things here with the psalm. We'll get to the book of James here in just a minute as we think about winding up. So, move us right along.
Well, I was just going to say about the psalm, it also ties in with the gospel lesson. It was picked for that. And verse 3, the snares of death encompassed me. The pangs of Sheol laid hold on me. I suffered distress and anguish. That ties into that whole segment of life, of suffering and death and resurrection, et cetera, and what happens in between. And one of the things I found very interesting here is verse 116:6. This always love the Lord protects the simple. When I was brought low, he
saved God.
Me. And that's one of my, I just love that line. And it's always been one of my favorite events in my life. And I don't mind telling the story again. One of my very first Sundays early in ministry in this little 3-point circuit in rural North Carolina. And I preached my heart out in that little white frame building with the dirt parking lot. And I was standing on the front porch shaking hands. And this woman came out and she said, we're going to like you here. And I said, well, I certainly hope so. And she said, yeah, you're simple minded like us. And I later decided that was the best compliment I'd ever gotten on my preaching because she had understood what I was talking
there
about.
There you go. The Lord protects Lord the simple.
When I was brought low, he saved me.
Amen.
And but particularly with the gospel lesson, as we tie this whole business of who Jesus is, this is where Isaiah and the psalm are coming from as they put this together, is reminding that this understanding of the Messiah did not come out of nowhere. That right. This has been a long-standing part of the tradition of what it means to be Israel, to be a part of God, the people, chosen people of God. And Jesus is a focus for Christians of Israel's calling into the person of Jesus the Christ, the Messiah, who embodies that suffering servant, the one who suffers and calls upon God. That's the other part of the psalm. The Lord protects the simple return. He has called upon God, and he feels that redemption. Another thing, just verse 2, just because the language falls out that way, but I think it embodies this. I often talk about the difference between if, then, and because, therefore, mm-hmm. theology. Right. If you do this, then God will bless you. If you pay a tithe, then you'll be prosperous. If you obey the Ten Commandments, then mm-hmm. God will love you. Notice it says, because he inclined his ear to me, therefore I will call on him as long as I live. God's priority of God's action.
That's it.
God because acts first, and we respond.
Because of the ways God has acted. Absolutely.
Therefore, we can have faith and trust. Mm-hmm. That's the core of it.
And that's an implicit argument I think you can make for the place where Jesus is coming from and what the deeper truth or example that he's trying to teach Peter and the other disciples. Again, in that gospel passage, I think it's very important to note when Jesus looks to the disciples, when he calls to the disciples, and then when he brings the crowd in with the disciples. Yeah, so always teaching, always, and there's an implicit theology here. God has acted. God is acting.
Yeah.
Therefore, we call. Therefore, we trust. And there it is, woven right into the midst of the psalm.
Yep. And last of all today, we have the book of James.
We already talked last week about how much Luther loved the Epistle of James. It's pretty good stuff.
It's pretty good stuff. It's more devotional and instructional than it is gospel proclamatory, perhaps, is what I want to say, you know? And that's
okay.
That might
work. That might work, yeah.
But, you know, it is tie in a bit with some of the other in terms of teaching and teach, you know? And I was going to say, this is a lot of people are starting their Sunday school. Last week was Labor Day weekend. A lot of times it starts the Sunday after. So you've got, has given me the tongue of a teacher in Isaiah. You have Jesus beginning to teach the people in the gospel lesson. And in this text, not many of you should become teachers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness. So if you're going to do a rally day sermon on Sunday school teachers, you've got three proof texts to jump on in.
Jump in there, man. Jump in there. Well,
I'm teasing at one level.
Yeah, but. Yeah. Well, we like to have a little fun, especially when we can poke a little fun at ourselves.
Exactly.
The Bubbas get a little uncomfortable with verses like verse 10. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this ought not to be so. That's a challenge for some of us, isn't it? He's a good boy. What are they going to do about that mouth, though?
Yeah, exactly. So there are some good, interesting illustrations about the power of the tongue.
Oh, yeah.
And I would have to say that the lack of civility in our current cultural climate, where you can't disagree with somebody without it being you're saying nasty things about their character. I miss, maybe they weren't as strong as I thought. As I read back over American history, we've always been pretty vociferous about the parentage of our enemies. But nonetheless, at least there was some periods in American history in which we could civilly debate and disagree and we about things, and it doesn't seem to be. And I think James is attacking some of that, that once you've said a thing, you can't take it back. And he's pretty clear. We know that this is most certainly true. And so if you need to talk to your congregation about talking nicely to one another and watching what you say, this would probably be a good verse for a good text for it.
There's a good one. And just be careful, you know. If you want to talk about the parentage of your enemies, I commend you once again to that great resource known as Monty Python. Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries.
And on that note, we might as well quit this week.
We better quit, Bubba. Not much else for us to do other than to tell everybody bye.
Everybody bye.
I've traveled down alone.
Lectionary Lab Live is a Two Bubbas and a Bible production. Our opening theme is Lock and Key by Silent Partner. We go out this session with Follow Me, composed by Ira Stanfill, performed by Larry Ford.
And I've oft complained to Jesus how folks were treating. Then I heard him say so tenderly, my feet were all so weary upon the Calvary road, the cross became the morning I can see. Just lift your cross and follow close to me.
Absolutely good.
Oh Jesus, if I die upon a foreign field someday, be no more than love demands, no less could I repay. No greater love has mortal man than for a friend to die. These are those words I gently heard him speak